areas of expertise is in using renormalization group techniques, both in non-perturbative quantum field theory as well as in quantum gravity.
Thanks, Marty, and thanks to the three organizers for this invitation. I thought this would be the perfect workshop to talk about the power of diversity. And the reason should be pretty obvious if you look around. It's because there are so many quantum gravity approaches present that we can really discuss why linking quantum gravity approaches could matter and could really trigger progress. And so if you take one thing away from this talk, then it's the call to discuss more with each other and to try to seek out links. So let's start with a view of what the status of quantum gravity appears to be. So there appear to be a lot of sort of disconnected bubbles. And just if you're wondering, I sorted them alphabetically. And we all exist in our tiny little bubbles that mostly just peacefully, sometimes not so peacefully, float around next to each other. And in most of these bubbles, interesting things are happening. So wouldn't it be much better if we would actually have this strong network of approaches where we really bring ideas together and we would try to really exploit progress in all of these various areas to really learn something about quantum gravity. And so the punchline of this talk is that I will try to make the case for why we should really try to work towards such a setting. I will do that from the point of view of asymptotic safety. So I will briefly introduce some aspects of asymptotically safe quantum gravity, and so that will be an incomplete introduction. I will then very selectively highlight some of the open questions, and I will use that to make the case that links to other quantum gravity approaches could really be what might help us to answer some of these open questions. So I will discuss proposals, how input from other approaches could provide answers. And at the very end, for the last 5 minutes, I will talk about singularity-free black holes as just one potential example where ideas from different approaches might be converging and where we have mathematical diversity but physical unity. As you can see, that's quite a long plan for this talk, so you should think about this talk as much more like a sort of collection of teasers of various ideas, and hopefully some of them will resonate with you and you'll come and talk to me more and discuss about them during one of the coffee breaks. So let's jump right in and talk about asymptotically safe gravity, which really is about scale symmetry. And scale symmetry is really just self-similarity. So as you zoom in further, you're just seeing the same picture, just in this mathematician's vision of what ferns should actually look like. And if you look around, then scale symmetry, approximate scale symmetry, is actually realized in quite a few examples in the natural world. You can even buy your own little version in the grocery store if you want to. And to me, that begs the question, well, could maybe scale symmetry be a much deeper principle of nature? And I think this is a question that does already resonate with various directions in quantum gravity, certainly ADS-CFT. Scale symmetry certainly is an important part of the conformal group. But scale symmetry also is what underlies the search for a continuum limit in spin foams, in dynamical triangulations, both with and without the C, as well as in tensor models. And of course, in asymptotically safe quantum gravity, scale symmetry really takes the center stage. And so that's what I will be talking about for the first bit of my talk. So asymptotically safe quantum gravity is a scenario that applies to quantum field theories. And so we have to think about what scale symmetry means in a quantum field theory. And of course, in a quantum field theory, quantum fluctuations in general generate a scale dependence of the effective dynamics. So you do not have scale symmetry typically in the presence of quantum fluctuations. But there is two ways of restoring scale symmetry. One is just if you switch off the interactions, and if asymptotically your couplings just all vanish, then of course you just recover classical scale symmetry. That's in some sense sort of the boring way of getting scale symmetry back in a quantum field theory setting. So that's asymptotic freedom. Of course, physically, that is by no means boring. It has quite intricate infrared dynamics. But in terms of the realization of the symmetry, it's sort of less interesting. There is a non-trivial way how to get back scale symmetry, which you could think of as quantum scale symmetry. which arises in the presence of non-vanishing interactions, and which really arises because quantum fluctuations balance out and generate a regime where, as you go towards higher and higher momenta, or conversely, as you go to smaller and smaller length scales, your dynamics just becomes scale invariant. So this is what gives you quantum scale symmetry. Sometimes this is viewed as a sort of rather exotic scenario from the point of view of high energy physics. And just to show you that that isn't exotic from the point of view of quantum field theories, I've listed a number of quantum field theories which do have such quantum scale symmetry realizations. And these do, by the way, include D equal 4 gauge Yukawa systems, so models which are actually quite close to what the standard model is. So this is just to show you that that's not as exotic as it's sometimes proclaimed to be. Now, this is, of course, a very simplified sketch, which just includes one single running coupling. But in general, the dynamics in any field theory is, of course, parameterized by an infinity of possible coupling constants, namely all of those that are compatible with the symmetries. And then the picture that we have in general is that quantum fluctuations generate a non-trivial scale dependence, which when we start at some scale with some specific value for all of the couplings, drives us along one of those trajectories. But there can then be such scale symmetric points where if you sit in that point, you will remain scale symmetric forever. But of course, there are relevant perturbations which can drive you away from that. There are also so-called irrelevant perturbations which drive you towards that. And because this concept will be quite important, let me just highlight that a little bit more. And let me first look at the irrelevant directions.
Can you use beta g in the previous slide?
Oh, so this is the beta function. That's the scale derivative of this thing. So this is just gives you the differential equation you have to solve to then give these trajectories. Yeah, thanks for the question. So here, I'm just looking at an irrelevant or actually infrared attractive direction. And you can very clearly see that this fixed point here is infrared attractive. If you start away from that fixed point, quantum fluctuations drive you towards it. So in this case, quantum fluctuations drive you towards this enhanced symmetry. They drive you towards scale symmetry. And as a consequence, you get a universal value of that interaction at low energies. You get that in particular if you really start with a UV complete scale symmetric theory, where you're sitting exactly on this dashed line. But you also get that even if you start away from scale symmetry at higher scales, then you're driven towards scale symmetry and you end up with this one universal value of that coupling. The converse is true for the relevant directions. Those are the ones where a tiny perturbation away from the scale symmetric point will just lead you away from scale symmetry. So quantum fluctuations then just drive you away. And you can see that at low energies, basically any value of that coupling can be reached starting from a scale symmetric point. And so these are the three parameters of our theory. So putting these two together then gives you a picture like that, where you do have the infrared attractive directions along which you're driven towards this purple hypersurface, towards the critical surface. You're driven towards the fixed point. And then you have those directions within this critical surface along which you're driven away from the fixed point. And one important misconception is that it's not true that a fixed point is unambiguously a UV or an infrared fixed point. This would only be true if a fixed point only had infrared attractive directions or only infrared repulsive directions. In general, a fixed point can be a UV or an infrared fixed point. It depends actually on the specific trajectory that you live in. And just to make this point clear, because it will be important later when I try to link up to other approaches, let me show you this sketch here. So there's four fixed points here in this very simple two-dimensional theory space. And this one here, you can see all of the arrows go towards that. So this is completely infrared attractive. So this is a fixed point that you would genuinely call an infrared fixed point, simply because you cannot flow out of it as you go towards lower energies. Then this fixed point down here, you see all of the arrows go out of it. So you would call this genuinely a UV fixed point because there is no way to approach it as you go towards the infrared. But these two fixed points here, they are different. So this one can be either the infrared endpoint of a trajectory that starts at the fixed point here. So you flow from here to here. then this is an infrared fixed point. But you can also start at this fixed point in the UV and then flow towards this infrared fixed point. And so this is one example that just clarifies that a fixed point a priori is not on its own UV or infrared. It actually depends on the trajectory that you specify. And you can also see this in this plot here. So you can reach this guy here coming from somewhere else in the infrared, but you can also start from this guy here and go somewhere else towards the infrared. And so this will become important later on when I talk about potential links to other approaches. So this is sort of, in a nutshell, the key idea of asymptotic safety. Now, what about its realization in gravity? First of all, what it would mean would be the following, that beyond the Planck scale, where quantum fluctuations of gravity are present, they actually generate quantum scale invariance, so they allowed to balance out all of the couplings in the theory. By the way, what we are talking about are all of the couplings multiplied by an appropriate power of the scale, so that we talk about dimensionless couplings. And quantum fluctuations of gravity balance out these interactions so that they all just become constant in this regime. So this doesn't hold just for the Newton coupling, it holds for all of the other couplings as well. And then there are a number of relevant perturbations, and the Newton coupling is actually one of them, and that can drive you away from the scale symmetric regime. And that happens at the Planck scale. So this is where you start deviating from scale invariance, and then very quickly quantum fluctuations of gravity just switch off and become unimportant. So that's sort of the picture of what asymptotic safety in gravity means. Now, what do we know about this realization? Yeah?
You're saying that scale symmetry switches off at the Planck scale, and you also have quantum scale invariance in that.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. I mean quantum scale invariance in the sense of an interacting fixed point. So this is present in this regime, but here a relevant perturbation kicks in and just drives you away from this fixed point.
Sorry.
And this then obviously leads us to sort of our everyday world, which, I mean, it's clearly not scale symmetric, right?
Then you go towards the infrared.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it necessary that that scale invariance kicks in at the Planck scale? I mean...
No. This is sort of the sort of most conservative assumption that you make, that you say, well, what we think of as the scale of quantum gravity, namely the Planck scale that we construct, you know, from H bar C and the classical value of G, we assume that that will also be the transition scale to the fixed point regime. But a priori, you could, of course, shift that around somewhat. But of course, ultimately, if this is a relevant perturbation, then you can just match different infrared values. And of course, ultimately, you compare to experiment, and that allows you to decide which of the trajectories you live in. Right. So there's a number of different techniques that one can use to study that. For instance, the epsilon expansion around the critical dimension for the Newton coupling, and if one could drive that to the third or fourth order in epsilon, then one could more or less reliably use a Padea resummation to extend this to d equal 4. Max Niedermayer has worked in one-loop perturbation theory to find indications for asymptotic safety, but the two technical approaches that I use most are the lattice approach that Renate was introducing yesterday, both with and without the C. And here, scale invariance really means that you can take a universal continuum limit. And the universality is, of course, really important because we don't really believe that space-time is constructed out of little tetrahedra or whatever your favorite geometric building block is. And so we don't want the low-energy physics to depend on these choices of the regularization. And scale invariance is exactly what allows us to achieve such a universal continuum limit, because then we can really take the lattice spacing all the way to zero, and then, of course, it doesn't matter anymore for the infrared physics. The other approach that is used, the other technical approach that is used, is the functional renormalization group, where scale invariance means that you can take a universal limit of this momentum scale to infinity. And in order to properly introduce this method and also tell you about its application to many other fixed points, which take significantly more time than I can bribe Sumati with. So let me just be very brief here. So the FRG in brief is the following. It will become important later on that here we are in a Euclidean setting, so I will come back to address that. And we're probing the scale dependence of such a quantum field theory, here for simplicity just shown for a scalar field, by introducing a scale k and momentum dependent mass term. We choose it such that it vanishes for the high momentum modes. So this means that they don't get a mass, they just are allowed to fluctuate here, they are integrated out, and they contribute to the effective dynamics. And the low momentum modes, we suppress them with a heavy mass, so that at k, the momentum modes with smaller momenta are not yet included. And then as we lower k, we step by step include more quantum fluctuations. And so if we understand the scale derivative of this effective action, then this actually is nothing but just the sum of all of the beta functions of the couplings, multiplying the appropriate operators. And these are the objects that we're interested in. And structurally, these are given by a functional differential equation, which has a technical one-loop form, which just means that one can actually, in practice, do calculations with this thing. Let me emphasize the one important point about this technique is that essentially any calculation one does in quantum field theory involves some approximation somewhere and will therefore have some form of systematic error. Here, the approximation is the following. So this effective action contains all infinitely many couplings that are compatible with the symmetries. And in practice, that, of course, is difficult to deal with. So we truncate to a finite or a typically finite subset of operators. And of course, here it's important that there is a controlled guiding principle for these truncations so that one has an idea that the operators that are being neglected are actually subleading. And the candidate guiding principle here is a sort of near perturbative nature of this gravitational fixed point, which means that the scaling exponents of this interacting fixed point roughly follow the classical scale. Right. And so this is just a quick flash of the results. So these are the indications for a, let me emphasize, Euclidean gravitational fixed point in d equal 4. And so this list just shows you a subset of what has been done by the community, including a variety of different couplings. And this picture here, where there is the scale symmetric point in the plane spent by the Newton coupling at the cosmological constant, it just extends to all of these directions. So you see quite a bit has been done. Some of the more complicated tensor structures, of course, are also still missing, simply because they are technically quite challenging. Let me also highlight that out of these many couplings that have been included, three of those correspond to three parameters to relevant directions. And then all of these higher order couplings correspond to these irrelevant directions, which means that their values are in principle calculable or predictable. And so here's one way how you would, in a Gedanken experiment, be able to test asymptotic safety. You would actually be able to measure the values of these higher order curvature operators, and then you would compare them to these predictions, and that would allow you to determine whether you're lying on the critical hypersurface of this fixed point or not. In practice, of course, even with the great advances in the strong gravity regime, we can't really measure the values of all of these couplings. So instead, the idea that has been sort of followed in the community is that a potential way of testing these ideas is through the interplay with matter. And of course, the first consistency test is whether you can take the standard model, include it into the setting, and you still get a gravitational fixed point. And the answer appears to be yes, although less different gravitational operators have been tested here. Then there's the converse side that I would like to spend a few minutes on, because here this whole scenario could actually have a predictive power that might potentially allow you to then really test this. And so just to be specific, let me talk about the impact of quantum gravity fluctuations on the abelian gauge coupling in the standard model. And so to set the stage, let me remind you that the abelian gauge coupling has what is called a triviality problem. And to understand that, it's enough to look at the one loop beta function for the abelian gauge coupling, which comes with a positive sign. And that means that if you go towards higher momenta, as you go towards the UV, the value of the coupling will increase, and it will actually hit a pole, the so-called Landau pole, at a finite scale. Now, if you hit a pole in this running coupling, that of course just signals a breakdown of the theory and means that you're missing some degrees of freedom. So now you could say, well, is there any way of pushing this scale where the divergence happens to infinity so that I actually have a theory that is complete on its own? If you do that, then you're forced to take the low energy value of the coupling to zero. Then you get a non-interacting trivial theory. So this is what the triviality problem is all about. Now let me add gravity and let me just highlight the appropriate disclaimers. So I am working in a truncation of the operator basis here, as I was telling you about before. There is a truncation scheme that I'm following, which implies that we do include the leading order gravitational effects. Let me also highlight, and maybe this is a point for closer discussion, that the gravity contributions to the beta functions are not universal, so not scheme independent, which means that the FRG will in general give you a different result than if you apply another scheme. But that's actually not something that is unfamiliar in the standard model. We are just not confronted with this as much because universality sets in only at three loops and beyond. But in general, beta functions aren't physical universal objects. Okay, so with these caveats, let me tell you what we have found. And so this is work that I'll be highlighting mostly with Fleur Vasseren, who was a PhD student of mine, and also more recently with Mark Schiffer, who's another PhD student, and Gustavo De Brito, who's a visiting student from Brazil. So the gravity contribution here is linear in the gauge coupling, which actually looks like an effective change of dimensionality. And I'm sort of finding that intuitive. If you just think very heuristically about what you would expect the effect of quantum gravity to be on a matter system and sort of fluctuations of the geometry, that is something that for a matter field effectively looks like a change in dimensionality. That is maybe something that sort of provides you some intuition for why you would expect such a term to be there. So don't pay any attention to what this FG looks like. This is just to basically motivate why it makes much more sense to just write this one parameter instead of this long equation. But it depends on the gravitational couplings. So the Newton coupling, cosmological constant, also curvature squared couplings, and so on. But the key feature of this object is that it is constant in the scale invariant regime above the Planck scale, and it switches off very quickly below the Planck scale where quantum gravity fluctuations switch off. And the presence of this guy really alters what happens to the abelian gauge coupling. So this negative sign here means that the free fixed point is now infrared repulsive, and also you can balance these two contributions out at an interacting fixed point. And this is the one that is truly interesting. This fixed point here is infrared attractive, which you can sort of see it attracts these trajectories coming from the other directions. And therefore, this means that the abelian gauge coupling is then something that comes out as a unique prediction from this fixed point, simply because you have to, the quantum fluctuations will always drive you towards this specific universal value. They will never drive you away from it. Of course, then below the Planck scale, where quantum gravity switches off, from there you just follow a flow driven by the standard model couplings.
So when you say that it could act as an
So this is the result, what it looks like. And this, if you would just look at the field theory in a changed dimensionality, you would also get a linear term like this.
Yeah, but always with the negative coefficient or?
That depends on whether it's a dimensional increase or a dimensional reduction. So the negative coefficient is what you would get from a dimensional reduction. So this might be something that Steve would find interesting potentially. Right. So these calculations here, of course, I've emphasized that they come with certain caveats, but you can read them as a hint for a gravity-induced ultraviolet completion that solves this triviality problem, and that would be quite interesting because it could come with an enhanced predictive power, fixing a free parameter of the effective field theory. If you're not a fan of asymptotic safety, then by the way, you can also just read this as a parameterization of scale invariant non-gravitational beyond standard model physics. Just as an aside. How I'm doing on time? Okay. I think I will nevertheless. Okay, great. So then I will actually highlight that the predictive power could actually extend a little bit because what I was telling you previously might actually only work in d equal 4 dimensions. And so that would mean that this scenario would actually potentially allow us to fix some of the or predict some of the parameters of the dimensionality. So let me just highlight that this is work by Mark Schiffer, and feel free to ask me more questions about this, I think, exciting result during the coffee break. So let me now highlight selectively some of the open questions in asymptotic safety and ideas how the connection to other approaches might provide answers. And I will also try to highlight that such a connection might actually not be sort of just interesting in the one direction, but that also seeking the connection to asymptotic safety might be something that is of interest to the other approaches. So let's start with unitarity. So first of all, very briefly, why is unitarity a question that is being raised about asymptotic safety? Well, it has to do with the presence of all of these higher order operators. And to very briefly see the problem, why higher order operators can, let me emphasize can, but need not, so this is not an automatic conclusion, they can be problematic. And to see that, just look at this propagator here, which has a higher order derivative term. And you can take that apart to just the standard massless graviton propagator, and then an additional massive mode, which comes with the opposite sign. And you would interpret that as a violation of unitarity, or in the classical theory, this is just a signal of instability, actually of the Ostrogradsky instability. Note that there's, of course, a bunch of subtleties when we think about unitarity in quantum gravity. For instance, this flat background expansion that I was using here might actually not be the appropriate expansion. It might just be telling us that, yes, Minkowski spacetime is unstable, but we actually don't even live in Minkowski spacetime, so that's not a problem. But the status of unitarity in asymptotic safety is simply that the form of the full propagator is not yet known. And so the answer to the question, is it unitary or not, is a simple, we don't know yet. We would like to know. But in the meantime, this motivates to think about what we call non-fundamental asymptotic safety. And this brings me back to this point that I was making, that a fixed point is not on its own UV or infrared. So the simple idea of non-fundamental asymptotic safety is that instead of defining a theory which starts at this asymptotically safe fixed point in the very, very, very deep UV, you actually have some scale KUV beyond which some more fundamental description sets in. And here you can pick whatever your personal favorite quantum gravity approach is. And then if this, this more fundamental description, it determines the values of the couplings at that cutoff scale. Essentially, as always, whenever you have a more microscopic model and an effective description, the microscopic model determines the parameters in the effective description. Think of how the viscosity in hydrodynamics is actually determined by whatever molecular microscopic interaction you have. So in that way, the more microscopic model sets your initial conditions here. And it can, of course, happen that the initial conditions lie somewhere where you're then attracted towards the fixed point, and you're then approaching the asymptotically safe fixed point as essentially a form of infrared fixed point from your more fundamental theory. Yes?
The issue of unitarity is something that points should not be there in the low energy, in the infrared, when you're looking at the quantum fields. But you're saying that somehow when you're in the UV, that you're not sure whether the theory is.
Yes.
But you know that at least in one limit of the theory, you recover unitarity. In the infrared, because otherwise.
So strictly speaking, we don't know that because we don't know what the full effective action looks like that comes out of its approach, right? I mean, so if you have unitarity violation microscopically, then you will generically expect that that actually also survives macroscopically, unless, of course, and this is the idea of this non-fundamental setting here, when the modes that violate unitarity have a mass scale that lies beyond KUV, then that's fine. Then I mean, those are sort of fake degrees of freedom that don't really exist, that are being taken off by whatever your more fundamental description is.
Your standard quantum field theory should be unitary. And mm-hmm. So on.
Yes. I mean, and so here unitarity would be ensured if the more fundamental description is unitary, then of course the effective description just inherits that. Right? And so in some sense, you can just view that as a way around the question, is asymptotic safety or unitary or not? Because to some extent, we don't care about the answer here so much. We just care about that all of the unstable modes actually lie beyond that cutoff scale.
Okay, so you would have a non-unitary quantum theory of gravity.
No, I mean, here you would say it's a unitary theory in the effective description and also in the more microscopic.
Also in the microscopic.
But then sort of the burden is pushed onto whatever the microscopic theory is. Right. And so, this idea that the fixed point could actually be approached as an infrared fixed point from some more fundamental description, that's by no means a new idea. That has already been proposed by Roberto Percacci and Gianpaolo Vacca in 2010. But together with a few of my PhD students and with Shanta, the others from Boulder, and with Jan Pawlowski from Heidelberg, we've just spelled it out a little bit more in a context together with string theory. So very briefly, the idea here would be that beyond the string scale, string theory exists. And then from there, you flow in the effective description to an asymptotically, say, fixed point. And then there is this transition scale where you flow out of the scale symmetric regime again. In order for this to be realized, of course, you have to have a sufficient separation of these scales. And for instance, you can achieve that if the fixed point value for the Newton coupling is sufficiently low, because then fixed point scaling already sets it below the Planck scale. As another one of the potentially necessary conditions, one would have to check whether something like the weak gravity conjecture is satisfied in asymptotic safety or not. And I want to remain completely agnostic about whether the weak gravity conjecture has to be satisfied in effective descriptions from string theory or not. Let's assume that it is. Then we can check whether it holds at an asymptotically, say, fixed point. And the answer is yes, if we go to this fixed point that I was talking about with the finite value of the gauge coupling, then potentially the weak gravity conjecture can hold, but there's additional conditions that arise on the fixed point value. And so overall, such a setting just gives you a bunch of conditions on the various values on the various couplings in the theory. Now let me briefly highlight the other side. Why might this be interesting also to think about from a string theoretic perspective? This is because if you couple enough fermions to the theory, then we generically seem to be driven into a regime where the fixed point value for the cosmological constant is negative. But from there, the RG flow then can drive us back towards a cosmological constant that is positive. And I hear that the question of the sitter might or might not be problematic in string theory. Again, let me be agnostic about the answer to that. But what I would like to highlight here is that thinking about a connection to asymptotic safety and to gravitational renormalization group flows might just be an idea that could be worthwhile considering in this context, because it might allow you to connect a microscopic anti-de Sitter type solution with a macroscopic de Sitter-like solution. Right, so let me now come to the second one of the open questions that I would like to highlight, that of Lorentzian signature, that I would say is really one of the key questions in quantum gravity in general, simply because space-time really is fundamentally very different from space, and I think a causal set is a great way of understanding this. And so the calculations that I was showing you that the results here rely on are, as I've emphasized, they come from a Euclidean setting, because we actually want to impose a cutoff on the four momentum, and that is something that we cannot do in a Lorentzian setting. And so what I would like to propose is a way to search for Lorentzian asymptotic safety by actually thinking more about scale invariance, what it implies for discrete settings. And as I've emphasized, it implies that there is a universal continuum limit. And so this is something that I think we should explore in causal sets. So there will be more talks about causal sets, but let me give you a 30-second introduction to causal sets. The idea is that space-time consists of a set of space-time elements which have an order relation, precedes. So causality is built in into the very fundamentals of the theory. It's maybe the most Lorentzian approach to quantum gravity that you can think of. And there is a local finiteness condition, which means that between any two elements that you pick, there will only ever be a finite number of elements that lie between them. And so this is the discretization condition. And I think Sumati would subscribe to this interpretation that it's a fundamental discreteness of spacetime. Whereas I would like to advocate that this is really just a Lorentzian regularization of spacetime, and that the physical limit is the continuum limit. So the way to then search for asymptotic safety in this setting would be to just think of the gravitational path integral as the path integral over causal sets. That is just the regularized gravitational path integral, and we can plug in some action. And this action should be constructed just from quantities that are inherent to the causal set, like the number of elements or the N1 is the number of links, N2 is the number of two chains, and so on. And then in the space of these couplings, you can then just look at the phase diagram. And of course, that has already been done in some limited settings. And if and only if there is a higher order phase transition, then this means that there, if you go towards this point, the correlation length will diverge, and you can take a universal continuum limit. And that actually means that there really is quantum scale invariance or asymptotic safety in a truly Lorentzian setting. And so this is essentially what I would propose, how the link between these two approaches can help us to answer a key outstanding question in one of them. Why is this interesting for causal sets? Well, this is interesting for causal sets because of a potential question with potential issue with predictivity. Causal sets, in principle, have dynamics which have all of these infinitely many couplings. And if you just specify your theory at some cutoff scale, then just as an effective field theory, you have no principle to fix all of these infinitely many couplings. You have an infinite number of free parameters. Great, thanks. And one way to restore predictivity, as I've been emphasizing, is an asymptotically safe fixed point, because that means that out of the infinitely many couplings, you actually also get infinitely many relations, and there's only a finite number of free parameters that parameterizes the dynamics. And so I think any approach to quantum gravity which has sort of kinematical discreteness of this type needs to answer this question: how do you restore predictivity to such a setting? And taking the continuum limit is, of course, one of the potential possibilities. And so I think this is how this would also address what I think is a crucial question in causal sets. Right, so I think I have 4 minutes and 30 seconds left. And so this is just enough time to give you this thesis, this teaser of sort of mathematical diversity, but physical unity. And this has to do with black holes. So let's take a look at the Schwarzschild black hole. What I'll do is a sort of very simplistic argument of what the effects of asymptotic safety on a black hole could look like. So this is not a derivation. This is just an argument that inspires a sort of a metric that we would expect could capture some of the effects of quantum gravity. And the key thing to do here is to take into account that the Newton coupling has a scale dependence. The dimensionful Newton coupling is constant in the classical gravity regime. And in the scaling regime, the dimensionful coupling just has to scale as its dimensionality. So let's put this behavior into the classical Schwarzschild metric. And here, the energy scale that we would expect to be relevant would, of course, be the curvature scale. For the spherically symmetric case, that's just given by the Kretschmann scalar. And purely on dimensional grounds, this is a four-derivative quantity. We have to identify k squared with the square root of that. And this brings us to the scale identification. If we plug in this behavior of the Newton coupling with this scale identification into this metric, then we are getting an RG improved line element. Right? And as I've emphasized, this is not a derivation. This is just a sort of simple argument that leads you to expect that this metric could capture some aspects of quantum gravity. And quite interestingly, if you expand this, then you see that this actually features a de Sitter core. And so what the metric then looks like, this f of r, here you have the classical singular behavior from GR, and then you have this de Sitter core from quantum gravity, potentially. And the key effect here is that in a very similar way to what Abai was telling us previously, you can think of sort of quantum gravity giving you an effective repulsive force. And what this means is that the horizon, the point where the light cones are tilted enough so that even the outgoing geodesics will be ingoing, this point moves further inwards. And so this is exactly what you see here. The location of the classical horizon is at larger values of r than the location of the horizon in this quantum gravity case. So weaker gravity because of the quantum gravity effects means that the black hole will be more compact. And I'm finding that the sort of effective metric here or its sort of relations, sort of there's a number of very similar effective metrics which all share this characteristics. I'm finding that intriguing because it has been argued to be inspired by several different approaches to quantum gravity. And why is this interesting at the moment? It's because this might be something that now in the strong gravity regime, we can start to constrain observationally. And the way to think about this is that you can rewrite this in terms of an effective mass. And the effective mass at very large distances is just the classical mass. But then as you go further inside, you see that the effective mass is reduced. And so if you measure the effective mass at the horizon, it is generically smaller than the effective mass further outside.
What do you mean by measuring it at, I mean, this is GR, we don't measure masses.
No, we do.
We don't measure masses except asymptotically.
No, but so the size of the shadow in the image plane is directly determined by the mass of this object, by the effective mass that you have at the radius of where the innermost stable orbit or where the light ring is created. So there is a way, I mean, so the Event Horizon Telescope extracts a mass from a measurement that is related to what happens close to the horizon. And of course, you can also extract masses observationally by just looking at the orbits of stars further outside. And so from all of these models, you would expect that these two effective masses differ. Of course, you would expect that they differ by a tiny, 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 tiny little bit. Because the quantum gravity effect is supposed to be very, very small. But on the other hand, that's a theoretical expectation. And I think, I mean, it's always safe to not trust the expectations that theoretical physicists have, right? In particular, because now we actually have the opportunity to go and test that. And if you're interested in more in this paper, we already derived what would be a first constraint on this quantum gravity parameter. And future observations will just allow us to constrain this regime even more. And of course, we don't expect to really be able to measure that, but I mean, who knows? And so instead of a summary, because I think I'm out of time, and really the key message that I would like you to take home from my talk is that at the moment, we don't really know what we are looking at, but if we bring all of these things together, then maybe we understand something more about quantum gravity. So thank you for your attention.
Any questions?
Your last hope was that at the horizon we could measure some quantum gravity effect. But I seem to disagree on that. So can you say something else?
Yeah. So
how realistic is that? And,
So it's all in this parameter gamma here, right? Which I mean, essentially it comes from sort of exactly the scale where you expect quantum gravity fluctuations to set in. And of course, the conservative assumption is that this parameter is ultimately determined by Planck scale physics, which is exactly what Abhay was saying. If you look at a solar mass black hole and you really put in this parameter as quantum gravity only sets in at the Planck scale, then this is just an incredibly tiny effect and it won't be measurable. But if you just view this sort of in a more agnostic way as sort of a simple, a very simplistic model for potential effects of new physics, then there's just a lot of parameter space that isn't observationally constrained, but that one can start to observationally constrain. And I completely agree with Abhay, if we're being conservative, that then we're not expecting to see any quantum gravity effects. But I mean, we have observational opportunities and we should just make use of them.
I agree with the philosophy, you can use parameter transition, but I don't agree with your description that it's a conservative thing. It's not that a conservative thing is to take this formula and put gamma to equal Planck length. Conservative thing is, a systematic thing is, we calculate what it is in a given theory, and that's what we've done. We calculated a given model, you know, mm-hmm. approach, and so it's not conservative in that sense.
No, I agree.
I agree. Unfortunately,
I mean, so you know, if you sort of argue for a metric like this in a sort of more simplistic way, as I've been doing, then you have this free parameter, and then it's a conservative choice to set it at the Planck scale. But of course, I mean, ideally, one really want to go beyond and really derive what the metric looks like from a given quantum gravity approach. And this is, of course, what I haven't done here for asymptotic safety.
I guess just a remark that it's not something that's happening at the horizon. It's a modification at the horizon. But it's just that there's an
change
in the metric.
Everywhere.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. So that just to emphasize, it's not just a local thing on the horizon.
No, sure. I mean, ultimately, the most significant change is, of course, where the classical singularity would be, and that there's just sort of, as you can see here, sort of the effects percolate further outwards, and of course, it becomes smaller and smaller the further you go away.
Okay.
And of course, how much this curve really has shifted, this is essentially encoded in this parameter.
Any other questions? Yeah.
You had this picture of like, you had like a Planck scale and I think a string scale maybe above it. I was just wondering if you have like a string scale that's below the Planck scale, which happens in a lot of string phenomenology, how does that affect the picture?
Yeah, so I mean, the one thing to take into account really that is sort of, I think, sort of unusual to think about from the point of view of string theory is that once you enter such a scaling regime, dimensionful quantities just scale with your scale. And so the Planck scale in this regime actually scales as k squared. And so this means that the string scale itself can in principle lie above what you would think as sort of the low energy Planck scale. But of course, what you ultimately want to achieve is this large separation of scale. And I mean, so at the moment, we don't have a concrete model that realizes this. This is a proposal for what this could look like. But of course, it would be quite constraining on the string theory and on the effective asymptotic safety set. So in principle, if you want to shift this scale sort of very far down, then for such a scenario to be realizable, you also have to shift this transition scale to the fixed point regime quite far down. And this in principle can happen if you couple a lot of meta degrees of freedom, then they drive the scale dependence of the Newton coupling that essentially gives you a very small fixed point value so that you hit the asymptotically safe regime quite early. So for instance, at the gut scale or even below.
One question,
mm-hmm.
which is that in all of this analysis in asymptotic safety, one assumes a local field theory.
Mm-hmm.
In causal set theory, we expect that there's fundamental non-localities that arise, and the field theories that we construct are things that they satisfy integral differential equations. So how much of the structure you're describing in asymptotic safety approaches relies on, I mean, I know the calculations are done there, but do you think that it's possible to incorporate, even in terms of F of R theories and so on, some elements of non-locality? And how robust would they be to such things?
So non-locality is quite a subtle issue because it depends on what exactly you mean by non-locality. If you mean higher powers of derivatives, something like as for instance encoded in F of R theories, then those are actually part of the calculations in any case. So the non-localities that we typically do not take into account are something that is inverse powers of derivatives, simply because these are operators that are canonically highly relevant, and so they would typically lead you to a fixed point which has an infinite number of free parameters.
Okay. So no further questions. Let's thank Astrid again.